Welcome to Sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto. Each week, we share a recording of the Sunday sermon, offering theologically progressive, social justice-oriented reflections grounded in Scripture and what's happening in our lives and in the world. Most weeks, the sermon is preached by our pastor, the Reverend Tom Harris, and from time to time, we're joined by guest preachers. In this sermon, after 3 weeks away, Reverend Harris continues his sermon series on the 10 requirements. Today's requirement is, do not commit adultery. Reverend Harris suggests that the meaning of this requirement meant something very different when it was written. It was related to men protecting exclusive sexual access to their property. That is a concept that is truly irredeemable. If we're going to find meaning in the complicated world of modern-day relationships, we need to reset this requirement in new words. Reverend Harris suggests honor intimate commitments and reflects on what it means to do that and what it means when we fail to do that.
So after a month-long pause in our 10 requirements series, today we pick up right where we left off. 4 weeks ago, we talked about the requirement, do not kill. And today, we move on to Exodus 20:14, do not commit adultery. So we talked about violence, we had a little break, and now we're going to talk about sex. I did warn you in the weekly email that this is a PG-13 sermon. And I'm glad I had some extra time to think about this one, because for one thing, infidelity is such a painful topic. If anybody's been touched by it, it's such a painful topic. And I want to be very careful how I talk about it. And almost undoubtedly, it is more common than we realize. In a University of Colorado study, 4,800 married women were interviewed and asked if they had been unfaithful in the previous year. 1% said they had. However, when the researchers asked the same question with an anonymous questionnaire, that number rose to 6%. And probably the true number is higher because people probably were lying on the anonymous questionnaire. And those were the women. Would the numbers be higher for men? Certainly the all men are dogs stereotype would suggest that the numbers would be higher for men. So this is this painful, taboo topic that is more common than we want to admit. I heard once that there are three A's that can kill a marriage: abuse, addiction, and adultery. And I think that's an oversimplification, and some marriages can survive all of those things, though I would say, as a caveat to that statement, that if abuse is happening, that the abused partner needs to get out as quickly as possible. Don't wait for it to escalate, don't wait for the person to change. Get out and get to a safe distance, and then decide what to do from there. But having said that, I think the three A's statement has some truth. Of all the things that cannot just harm, but kill a marriage, abuse, addiction, and adultery would seem to be at the top of the list. At the same time, the prohibition against adultery that we find in the 10 requirements is more than any other requirement tangled up with changing social norms and the complexity of human relationships. When this was written, marriage was something completely different than it is today. Or to frame that even more broadly, when this was written, social norms around human sexuality and sexual relationships were completely different. When this was written, marriage was only between a man and a woman or multiple women. And when this was written, the woman or women were basically the property of the man. The story of Jacob and his wives and his slaves is a great example of how different marriage was back then. Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, became the progenitor of the 12 tribes of Israel by having 12 sons with 4 different women, 2 wives, Leah and Rachel, and 2 of his slaves, Zilpah and Bilhah. And nowhere in that story is any of that critiqued or criticized or condemned. So not only does this story of Jacob demonstrate how different marriage was back then, but it even raises the question, what exactly would Jacob have had to do to commit adultery? And there's an answer to that question. If he had sex with another man's wife, another man's property, he would have been committing adultery. But as long as he was only having sex with his wives or his slaves, or probably an unmarried free woman, he was not violating the prohibition of adultery as it was written at the time. To put this very plainly, back then, adultery was entirely about men defending their exclusive sexual access to their property. And every word about that sentence is garbage. We can throw that entire sentence out. Men defending their exclusive sexual access to their property, throw it all out and start over. But before we do that, let's also talk about where we are with romantic relationships today. The fact is that modern romantic relationships are all over the place. People are meeting their needs in myriad ways. And maybe none of these are new. Maybe there's just a greater acceptance of some of these. But let's do a brief but incomplete survey. There's, of course, old-fashioned monogamy, which, as I just mentioned, is not so old-fashioned. Two people having sex with each other over a lifetime, and only with each other, may be the exception. It's hard to know because people lie on stuff like sociological surveys, but there certainly are people who do accomplish it. Real long-term monogamy and mazel tov to them. Then there is perhaps the more common serial monogamy, which is not just their dedication to one breakfast cereal every morning. When you are monogamous with one person for a while, and then you stop being monogamous with them and become monogamous with somebody else, that's serial monogamy. I once performed a wedding in which each person had been married four or five other times. And in case you're curious, it was a super fun wedding. She wore a camouflage dress that she had made from fabric she got at Walmart. And she came skipping down the aisle holding a single sunflower. They were at the point where they weren't taking any of this seriously anymore. And it was in somebody's backyard in South Carolina, and we had Frogmore stew at the reception. I know another couple who had both been married and divorced, and they both had been in very difficult marriages, but now they were deeply committed to each other, but had no intention of getting married because they didn't want to jinx it. Like, they knew what marriage was. They didn't want that again. They finally ended up getting married for tax purposes, though. And then there's polyamory, which is becoming more common these days amongst the young folk. There are triads and there are quads, and some of these are intentionally fluid, acknowledging that they may not last a lifetime, and that's okay. And the genders involved in these polyamorous relationships can be any combination and also can be fluid within the relationship. So there's that. And then there's what we call ethical non-monogamy, which is talked about more and more these days. Relationship therapist Dan Savage names three forms of ethical non-monogamy. One is open relationships, which may have rules and agreements and are open enough that they really aren't monogamous, yet there is one primary couple at the center. And then two terms that Savage coined, monogamish, which is a relationship that is mostly monogamous but has mutually understood exceptions. And then there's something he calls polyamory. Can you think about what that would mean? It's where one person has outside relationships that the other person suspects or knows about, but deliberately chooses to tolerate, and often without any explicit agreement. In other words, one partner looks the other way. And my parents were in a polyamorous relationship, so I know that one firsthand. So that's just a sampling of the profusion of modern human relationships in which we ask the question what adultery might mean and what it might mean to not commit it. In other words, how do we express the idea of adultery today in a way that is unfettered by patriarchy, misogyny, and puritanical sexual norms? And here's my suggestion for a reset of the seventh requirement. Honor intimate commitments. Honor intimate commitments. Let's start with the word honor, which you may remember from the fifth requirement, honor your parents. The Hebrew word that's translated honor has this literal sense of weightiness or weight. So give appropriate weight to your relationship with your parents. It doesn't mean necessarily obey them. It doesn't mean necessarily love them, although we should all try to love our parents. That's not what that requirement is about. To honor them is to acknowledge with appropriate weight the importance that they have in your life. So honor then, not just your parents, but honor all of our intimate commitments. Each of the next two words are powerful by themselves. Intimacy is that experience of being vulnerable and open to another person. It's the experience of removing our masks so the other person can see who we really are, and seeing another person with their mask removed as well, that they removed for us. It's about being close enough emotionally and or physically so that we can both love each other intensely and hurt each other profoundly. And then combine that experience of intimacy with a commitment to the person. So a promise to stay intimate over the long term. We promise through all of the ups and downs of life to stay close with our masks down, loving honestly and intensely, experiencing all of the pleasure of that vulnerability, and open to all of the wounding. And so those intimate commitments require honor. And that honor usually takes the form of agreements or rules or promises about what we will do and what we will not do. A commitment implies a promise. So even and especially in this day and age when there is this beautiful freedom to form the intimate committed relationships in so many different ways, we still need to be reminded that those intimate commitments are something very special. They're different from other intimate commitments. They're different from other non-intimate, non-committed relationships. Intimate commitments have a special weight to them. They require honor, and that honoring has to be intentional. I always tell couples when I'm meeting with them before a wedding that the most important part of the marriage service is the vows. Everything else is window dressing. It's the promises that they make to one another in front of God and their community. And sometimes I even if they are open to it, will step out of the way, remove myself from the center when it comes time for the vows, and just let those two people stand before everybody and make their promises to one another, because that's the foundation of what they're going to be doing. This journey of nurturing long-term intimacy is founded on those promises. I also encourage couples to write their own vows, even if they just want to do their traditional repeat after me during the wedding ceremony, but to think about for themselves, what are you actually promising to each other? And to carefully articulate those promises and to agree with each other about them. What are the boundaries? What are the rules? What are the promises? What are the shields that will guard this intimate commitment across the years? With that reset of the seventh tradition, we can also then talk about what it's like to dishonor an intimate commitment. A couple old-fashioned words are still very applicable for that dishonoring: unfaithfulness and infidelity. When we are unfaithful to the promises we make and the boundaries we set, we dishonor the intimate commitment. But infidelity can be about much more than just sexual infidelity. Sexual boundaries and rules are critically important to some intimate relationships, and the crossing of those boundaries are what most of us think about when we think about infidelity. But there is also such a thing as emotional infidelity or emotional affairs, which is a complicated idea because on the one hand, it's unrealistic to expect one person to meet all of our emotional needs for our entire lives. At the same time, many exclusive relationships have this implicit or explicit agreement when it comes to emotional intimacy with other people. Most would agree that you're not supposed to fall in love with somebody else. Even if you never touch the other person, don't fall in love with somebody else. Complaining about your intimate partner with someone that you feel an attraction to is probably a really bad idea. Sharing certain intimate secrets can be a transgression of those boundaries. So the emotional affairs are a very real thing. There's also cyber infidelity these days that may involve sex or it may not. And it may involve a real person or it may involve an AI. People are falling in love with AIs, and I know that that might be like a chuckle, roll your eyes, but it's doing real damage to relationships today. And then a form of infidelity that is perhaps the most common way we dishonor our intimate commitments doesn't involve another person at all or an AI. We may be unfaithful to our intimate commitments simply by when we stop showing up. If we stop showing up physically, emotionally, sexually, that's a form of infidelity. Because intimate commitments require that we keep showing up. I mean, that's the commitment part. You just keep showing up day after day, year after year. If one person is still showing up and the other person is not, or both people stop showing up, that's being unfaithful. So keep all of that in mind, and let's take a step back and observe that it is probably unrealistic to expect that the boundaries and agreements and shields that a couple of immature, idealistic 20-somethings make to one another are going to be the same boundaries, agreements, and shields that each person needs 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years later, because people grow and change, and sometimes in different directions, and sometimes the commitments have to evolve, and sometimes they come to an end. Gray divorce is trending. A recent New York Times article said that, quote, while divorce rates have been dropping across age groups in recent years, the exception to that trend is among Americans 65 and older, who are getting divorced at a higher rate than they used to. People married for decades are splitting up in retirement. That fact, I think, is a testimony to the reality that people grow and people change. And if we want to stay in an intimate relationship over the long term until one of us dies, we both need to keep showing up and staying honest and open and communicating with each other. I mean, it's cliche, but it's true. Long-term intimate commitments require work. Honoring intimate commitments involves doing the work, having the honest conversations about our changing needs. And those conversations can be hard and painful, especially if one person is changing while the other person isn't so much. But such honest conversations are better than one person unilaterally altering the commitment without the other person's consent. In other words, it's better to talk about changing than it is to cheat. Which brings me to my last point. We are all imperfect people. We are all broken, flawed, imperfect people, and the only way that intimate commitments can survive between imperfect people is through the practice of grace. None of us are perfect, and we will hurt one another, and we will be hurt. Getting hurt is what we sign up for if we're going to do this thing called committed intimacy. It doesn't mean we should be thoughtless or careless or take that for granted, and it shouldn't. It also doesn't mean that we allow ourselves to be doormats. Sometimes we honor an intimate commitment by ending it. Sometimes we honor an intimate commitment with abundant grace and forgiveness. I said earlier that adultery can kill a marriage, but it doesn't have to. In an ideal world, there's no cheating. And we all handle our changing needs with honest conversations with our intimate partners about our changing needs, and we adjust over a lifetime with perfect emotional maturity and skillful communication and open-mindedness. But in the real world, sometimes a person doesn't know what their needs are until they have cheated. Sometimes the unmet need is revealed by the infidelity. And maybe that ends the relationship. Maybe the relationship doesn't survive that, and no one would blame somebody for leaving a cheating partner. But if both people want to stay together and can recommit and maybe renegotiate their promises, and can practice abundant grace based in love, then intimate commitments can survive infidelity and can become stronger. In the end, each person in each couple or triad or quad, whatever, has to decide what it means for them to honor their intimate commitments, to give them the weight that they deserve. Each needs to decide what exactly they're committing to, what are the rules, what are the boundaries, what's allowed for each person to feel loved and safe, and what's not allowed. And maybe that conversation happens explicitly, or maybe it just happens implicitly and you get lucky and can work it out without ever talking about it. Maybe honoring the commitments means staying together, or maybe it's not. But if we're going to stay together, we are going to need the grace, and lots of it. Now, we might hear all this and wish for a simpler time, when society had clear expectations for marriage and when people stayed married. But we all know if we think about that just a little bit, we don't want that back. Because we want the freedom to love who we love and to leave or to stay without society enforcing universal rules upon us from the outside. And so that leaves us with this complex situation, this world filled with intimacy and wounding and commitments and cheating and love and heartbreak and failures and grace and renewals and endings and beginnings. And the best guidance we may have is not a hard and fast rule that is true for every person in every relationship, but instead we get this sort of directional sign reminding us that intimate commitments are something different. They are special, and they need special care. They need special boundaries and rules and promises and honesty and love and probably some humor and abundant grace and a lot of hard work. In other words, if we are going to make intimate commitments, we need to honor them. Amen.
Thanks for listening to sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto, located at 1140 Cowper Street in Palo Alto, California. If you'd like to worship with us, we gather Sundays at 10 a.m., both in person and online. And you can find more information about our congregation, worship, and ministries at fpcpaloalto.org. We hope to see you soon.